Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers, Financial Services and E-Commerce, Labor and Employment Law, and Litigation Practice Groups. It was recorded on Wednesday, February 20th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing fallout from the Noel Canning recess appointments case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks of about 5 to 10 minutes from each of our three speakers, followed by an exchange among our speakers, and then followed by your questions. We'll hear first from Rachel Brand, who's Chief Counsel for Regulatory Litigation for the National Chamber Litigation Center, the public policy arm of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. She's the former head of the Department of Justice Office of Legal Policy. Then we'll hear from Howard Radsley. He is the former Deputy Secretary and Solicitor at the Department of Labor. And finally, we'll hear from John Elwood, who's a partner at Vinson & Elkins Law Firm, where he focuses on litigation in constitutional, criminal, administrative, employment, and environmental issues. He's a former senior deputy in the DOJ Office of Legal Counsel. And with that, Rachel, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Okay, thank you, Dean. I appreciate the opportunity to participate today. I'm going to talk about the Noel Canning case itself, and Howard and John will discuss the impacts of the decision later. I have more than a passing interest in this case, having been in all the merits briefs in my capacity with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. But before I get to the case itself, I'll give some quick background on the recess appointments clause. As you no doubt know, the Constitution generally requires that officers of the United States be appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate. Of course, the recess appointments clause provides an exception to this rule. It states, quote, "The President shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session." There are a couple of hundred years of very interesting history between the drafting of those words and today, and I'll give you just a couple of quick highlights in light of the time. In recent years, there have been two types of recess appointments. First are inter-session recess appointments, which are those appointments made during the one recess a year between the end of one session of Congress and the beginning of the next. Congress commonly makes a final adjournment of a session of Congress sometime in December and then stands in recess until January 3 at noon, which is when the 20th Amendment requires Congress to convene each new session. Second are intra-session recess appointments, which are those appointments made during recesses in the middle of a session of Congress, such as the Easter recess or the August recess. Intra-session recess appointments are a relatively new phenomenon. The D.C. Circuit noted in Noel Canning that no president attempted to make any intra-session recess appointment for at least 80 years after the Constitution's ratification, and only three appointments total, intra-session appointments, were made prior to 1947. And they really didn't become commonplace until much later, at the end of the Carter administration and beginning of the Reagan administration. Even after the advent of intra-session recess appointments, it was understood that an intra-session recess had to be of a certain length in order for the president to make a recess appointment during it. Numerous attorney general opinions acknowledge this. There was some murkiness in those opinions about how long was long enough, but it seemed clear that 3 days was the bare minimum. That minimum was informed by the Constitution's adjournment clause, which provides that neither house of Congress may adjourn for more than 3 days without the permission of the other house. Based on that understanding about a 3-day minimum, during the Bush administration, the Democrat-controlled Senate began a practice of coming into session every 3 days, rather than, say, going into a month-long August recess, to keep the president from making recess appointments. Every 3 days, the Senate would come into session for a few minutes in so-called pro forma sessions. The Senate continued to do that during the Obama administration, which brings us to the president's recess appointments to the NLRB in January of 2012. In the previous December, December 2011, the Senate had issued a scheduling order providing the Senate would come into session briefly every 3 days until late January. One of those scheduled brief sessions occurred on January 3 at noon to convene the next session of Congress. The next day, January 4, the president made 4 recess appointments, 3 to the NLRB and 1 to head the CFPB. This was something no president had ever tried before, insofar as he made the appointments during an intra-session recess that lasted less than 3 days. Because they were unprecedented, these appointments were immediately controversial, as you remember. I'm not going to recount all the arguments for and against the appointments, and I think John may go into some of that himself, but the justification given by OLC and by the government's briefs and litigation was basically that the Senate's brief sessions were shams, and that in reality the recess had lasted much longer than 3 days. We pointed out in our briefs that these sessions had to be legitimate because the Senate took significant actions during some of them. For example, in one such session in December, the Senate had passed the payroll tax extender bill, a major piece of legislation that the president then signed. And as I mentioned, Congress fulfilled its obligation under the 20th Amendment by convening on January 3 in one of those pro forma sessions. The validity of the appointments was not just an interesting academic constitutional question, because if three of the appointments of this five-member board are invalid, the board lacks the required three-member quorum and has no authority to decide cases or really conduct any business. So the appointments resulted fairly quickly in a flood of cases in which parties appealing adverse decisions added a challenge to the recent appointment's validity. One of those cases involved Noel Canning, a Pepsi bottler in Yakima, Washington. The NLRB had ruled against Noel Canning after the recent appointments were made in a case involving a sort of basic question about contract law. In March, then, we at the U.S. Chamber and the Coalition for a Democratic Workforce jointly moved to intervene on Noel Canning's behalf for the express purpose of briefing the recess appointments issue. And if I may engage in a little promotion of the Chamber here, we at that point we more or less took over the litigation of the case. The company and its outside local counsel worked very closely and well with us and agreed to file joint merits briefs with us and to allow our outside counsel, who was Noel Francisco from Jones Day, to do the oral argument. There was a lot of interest in this case. There were numerous amicus briefs on both sides, including on our side, a brief by Speaker Boehner and a brief by Senator McConnell and 40 other Republican senators. The court granted the senators oral argument time, too, and Miguel Estrada argued on their behalf. And just to give a quick note about the disposition of our intervention motion for those who care about procedural minutiae, when we made the intervention motion and briefed it, the merits panel of the court did not grant or deny it, but instead referred it to the merits panel of the court and asked us to re-brief the issue of standing. This allowed us, in effect, to function as though we were already a party throughout briefing and during the oral argument, but ultimately the court's written opinion dismissed our motion as moot. As you've no doubt heard, the court, in its written opinion, held the appointments unconstitutional. The court brushed off or ignored many of the arguments made in the briefing, including that the adjournment clause defined the minimum recess duration, and instead the court adopted our alternative argument based on the original understanding and text of the recess appointments clause. In an opinion by Judge Santel, the court reached two conclusions. First, the court held that intra-session recess appointments are never allowed. The recess appointments clause speaks of, quote, the recess of the Senate. Among other reasons, the use of the definite article indicates the framers were talking about the one recess between two sessions of Congress, not to any of the many intra-session recesses that might occur. Second, the court held, the president may only make recess appointments to fill vacancies that occur in the first instance during an intra-session recess, and he must make the appointment during that same recess. The court relied here on the recess appointments clause's reference to vacancies that, quote, may happen during the recess of the Senate. The court used an originalist interpretation to hold that the phrase, quote, may happen, means to occur in the first instance during the recess, not may happen to exist during the recess. Judge Griffith wrote separately to say that he wouldn't have reached that second question of what may happen means because it wasn't necessary to the disposition of the case. The three appointments to the board were unconstitutional under the first part of the court's analysis, that intra-session appointments are always unconstitutional, so the court didn't need to reach a second constitutional question. Under the majority's broad reasoning, almost all recess appointments in modern history were invalid. Most of the appointments during the last few administrations have occurred during intra-session recesses, and of the appointments made during inter-session recesses, few, if any, were made to fill vacancies that arose during the same inter-session recess. The question now is how the government will react to Noel Canning. The NLRB almost immediately said in the press that Noel Canning is just one decision by one court against one company and that it would continue to do business as usual. And it has continued to adjudicate cases despite the fact that it lacks a quorum under the court's ruling. The administration, the White House, and others have suggested that the government might not appeal Noel Canning, but might wait around for a circuit split to deepen. I think Howard's going to talk more about the cases pending all around the country in which recess appointments issues are presented and the cloud that's shadowing all the board's current actions. We at the Chamber have said, and we think the responsible thing for the government to do is to appeal Noel Canning right away and seek Supreme Court resolution of the issue as soon as possible, not to continue to operate as though nothing has happened. And the clock for that action is ticking. A petition for on-bank review in the D.C. Circuit is due in a couple of weeks, and if there is no petition for on-bank review, a cert petition is due in late April. And with that, I'll turn it over to Howard.
Thanks, Rachel. And I'll save my comments on the decision itself for later on in this program. And I want to focus on the impact the decision has on the NLRB. As Rachel mentioned, in order for the NLRB to act under the statute, it's required to have a quorum of three members. And the NLRB believed it had a quorum of three members because Chairman Pierce, who was confirmed by the Senate, was joined by two recess appointments, Block and Member Block and Member Griffin, who have now, under the Noel Canning decision, appointments have been declared unconstitutional. So at this point, as Rachel indicated, the NLRB, under the Noel Canning decision, has one member, and that does not have a quorum to act. As Rachel mentioned, in the immediate aftermath of the Noel Canning decision, Chairman Pierce indicated that the board would continue to operate as usual despite the decision. This has a number of raises a number of practical problems for the board, not the least of which is anybody challenging a board decision under the various statutes has a right to go to the D.C. Circuit to challenge that decision. So as a practical matter, while the board can continue to issue decisions, if the D.C. Circuit's decision is ultimately upheld by the Supreme Court, then all of the decisions will be invalidated, even the decisions they have continued to issue. And it's not, I'm not surprised that the NLRB took that position, because otherwise the NLRB would effectively have to shut down, which is not something that this NLRB, which has been extremely activist, wants to do. And I suspect that the NLRB is urging the Justice Department to seek Supreme Court review as quickly as possible. I thought, in order to give you some indications of what is likely to happen, it was good to look. It may be good to look back at a Supreme Court decision from a few years ago in New Process Steel, which was a decision which involved the board's attempt to delegate its quorum from three members to two members when it lost the third member of the board because their term was up. The Supreme Court held in that case that all decisions rendered from January 2008 through April 2010, where there were only two members, were invalid. In April 2010, two recess appointments actually were made to the board from April 2010 to June 2010, which, somewhat ironically, under Noel Canning, those decisions would now be ruled as well, inconsistent with the statute. But during this period, just to give you some sense, the board rendered some 600 decisions, of which 90 were challenged or were pending challenge when the Supreme Court ruled in New Process Steel in June of 2011, when it the ruling was handed down. Excuse me, 2010, when the ruling was handed down. The board was able to actually issue new rulings in some 70 of those decisions between June and August of the year the Supreme Court decided, in large measure because all of the 96 decisions at issue in New Process Steel, there was a Republican and Democrat that had to agree. So while some of the decisions may be viewed as controversial, they were not as controversial as the many decisions the board has issued over the last 12 to 24 months on a wide range of issues. So while the board, following New Process Steel, was able to quickly reissue most of the decisions, I think it is very, very unlikely that these decisions would issue as quickly if Noel Canning is upheld and the board is forced to re-rule on numerous decisions. Just to give you some comparison, there have been about 1,000 decisions issued by the board of some capacity since the date that everyone is focused on, which is January of 2012. But in fact, under the D.C. Circuit's analysis, the board has been without a quorum since August 28, 2011, when then-Chairman Liebman's term was up, and there were two members, now Chairman Pierce and then Member Hayes, and recess appointee Member Becker. So under the board's analysis, in fact, it's more than just the decisions rendered since January 9, 2012, but actually will extend back to August 28, 2011. And in fact, just yesterday, the D.C. Circuit, I think, publicly recognized that fact because in the Quickie election case, which was scheduled for oral argument in the D.C. Circuit on April 4th, the court held it in abeyance, didn't expressly state why, but presumably because of Noel Canning, because member Becker met neither of the two prongs of the Noel Canning decision that Rachel just outlined. In addition to that, those of you who may be wondering about the NLRB's other rulemaking, notice posting, which was struck down by a district court within the Fourth Circuit, but upheld by and large by a district court in the D.C. Circuit, that case is unlikely to be impacted by this recess appointments decision because at the time the rule was adopted, then-Chairman Liebman was still on the board, so there were three confirmed members of the board. Thus, the board likely had a quorum at the time the notice posting case was issued. Let me just give you a couple other practical aspects that I think we may see come up in the courts before the Supreme Court has a chance to rule on this. First of all, the board has continued to appoint regional directors, and it's likely that the board lacks authority to appoint regional directors because they have a quorum. In the aftermath of New Process Steel, the board ratified all personnel decisions, including the appointment of regional directors during the period which it lacked a quorum. I expect that the board will do the same if and when they ever get a properly constituted quorum, but that may not stop some employers and potentially some unions from challenging actions taken by regional directors who arguably were appointed without authority because there was no quorum. In addition to that, and something of more immediate consequence, is 10J injunctions. Under Section 10J of the National Labor Relations Act, the board is authorized to seek injunctive relief in district court for violations of the act. During periods in which the board thought it was going to lose its quorum, it often delegated to the general counsel the right to exercise this authority. The board did so here on November 9, 2011, in anticipation of member Becker's recess appointment running out. However, I believe that this delegation is itself ultra vires because on November 9, 2011, under the Noel Canning rationale, the board itself lacked a quorum. Thus, I would expect to see if the board attempts to exercise its 10J power in any form, by itself or through delegation to the general counsel, that will likely get an immediate decision from a district court on the constitutionality of the recess appointments. With that, I know there's a lot more we could talk about on this issue. I'll turn it over to John to talk about the specifics of the rationale of the D.C. Circuit.
Thanks, Howard. This is John Elwood. I handled recess appointments both while I was in the Office of Legal Counsel and the Office of the Solicitor General. Judge Silberman is reported to have said recently that judges who've worked in the executive branch have a, quote, profound distaste, unquote, for Congress. And that's not quite true of me. I don't have distaste for Congress, but I do have my kind of pro-executive branch and pro-president view of things. And I'll give you that disclosure right up front. I think that the recess appointments that the president made last January 4th were, you know, well within keeping with ordinary presidential practice with one enormous caveat. And this is such a big caveat that it kind of swallows everything else. And that is, except for the pro forma sessions. They were the first, this was the first recess appointment made with the Senate sitting in pro forma session. And as Rachel kind of alluded to, it was a particularly, I think, poor test case from the point of view of anybody who wants to have this thing upheld, because there are three basic differences from when this was done during the Bush administration. The first is that the pro forma sessions were being held not only just to frustrate the president's ability to make recess appointments, they were being done to satisfy the requirements of the 20th Amendment that they meet on January 3rd. They were done to satisfy the terms of the adjournment clause that neither house can adjourn for more than 3 days without the permission of the other. And so that it was valid for both of those purposes, and there's a long tradition of using pro forma sessions for both of those purposes. So it wasn't just a case of them trying to frustrate the president's in his recess appointment ability. The other thing that made it kind of a bad test case is that Congress actually passed legislation during that recess. They had during the entire time, I think there were 22 sessions, pro forma sessions under the Bush administration. No legislation that I'm aware of was actually passed. But during this kind of longer recess, the payroll tax extension was enacted shortly before Christmas to avoid an increase in tax rates. And actually during the August recess that preceded it, the Airport and Airway Extension Act was enacted during those pro forma sessions, which I think together that made it a particularly bad test case. Now, I was originally persuaded this is something that I'd looked at, and, you know, generally speaking, I am relatively favorably disposed to the idea that the president might be able to make recess appointments during, you know, despite the fact that the Senate is in pro forma session. In my view, the originalist sources, including, you know, anti-federalist papers and founding-era documents, they took sort of a practical view of what the recess appointment clause was for. They distinguished between the sitting of the legislature and when it's in recess, that is, basically when the advisors could not be consulted. So when the Senate can't be consulted on appointments, whether that is because of a intersession recesses or an intra-session recess, or because they're only there in pro forma session and banging the gavel. Those pro forma sessions typically last under a minute. They're usually about 30 seconds. They're not really able to be consulted. That's the view that the Senate Judiciary Committee took in a report they did in 1905, which has been kind of seminal in this field. It's the view that Attorney General Doherty took in 1921. And that's, you know, the way it certainly has worked for about the last century in the executive branch practice. And these sessions only have the form of a session. They don't have any of the substance. The recess order says no business is to be conducted. And furthermore, you know, I think that there is a somewhat appealing argument to be made that one branch can't just nullify the power of another. And by saying, you know, none of us consider we're in session because they refer to it as recess, they're being in recess even when the pro forma sessions are ongoing. You know, it seems kind of not cricket, to use the British term, to say, even though we're not actually meeting, you can't make recess appointments. And I think it's telling that Congress, during each of these breaks, they actually provide for their own recess appointments. Before Congress goes out, they delegate to their ability to make appointments within Congress and to various commissions and boards and such to the leadership. And so they themselves recognize that they're not really available to conduct business. So that is the view that I generally previously took about pro forma sessions, that they were not sufficient. As it happens, in the process of mooting Jones Day for the argument in this case, I've kind of come around to this view. And these are the things that made me think that these pro forma sessions mean that the Senate is actually available. The first thing that struck me is that when these pro forma sessions are held, admittedly, there's only one Senate in the chamber. But all the personnel are available. All of the Senate staffers are available who need to be present to, if they were going to pass legislation, they could do it at the drop of a hat. Secondly, I think it's significant that most legislation in this day and age is passed by unanimous consent and thus could be done in essentially an empty chamber with one senator present. And then a third thing is the fact that they did, in fact, pass legislation. And so I have to say that I have come around on this, and I think that, you know, I think that with all of these factors that I've mentioned recently, the presence of the personnel, the fact that legislation is routinely passed by unanimous consent, and the fact that they did pass legislation during this very recess is an indication that the Senate was, in fact, available to advise on appointments. It just chose not to. And you can't force the Senate not to unless you're going to get on a very slippery slope. I mean, if you can make recess appointments when the Senate isn't listening and isn't, you know, they've decided they're not going to vote on your guys, then that is distorting the Constitution. With that said, I will now go to the pre-caveat explanation, which is that aside from the pro forma sessions, which again is a big aside, the president's recess appointments otherwise were kind of in the tradition going back to Reagan and, you know, somewhat less frequently going back to Truman and Roosevelt, going back to Coolidge, and going back all the way to President Johnson. And that is, first, on the intercession versus intercession point. It is true that no intra-session recess appointments were made for many, many years, but that's because, you know, Congress would come and do their business and then they'd go home. And there really weren't intra-session recesses. Before 1857, there were only three intra-session recesses that were 5 days or longer. There were 2 5-day ones and 1 7-day recess. During the first intra-session recess of more than 2 weeks, which was in 1867, President Johnson made 14 recess appointments, and he made intra-session recess appointments twice more during his presidency. And Congress, which you will recall did not exactly hesitate in complaining about President Johnson's actions, said boo about it, although I don't think that is all that significant just because it's so far outside the founding era, I don't know that you can take much from it. I am not that impressed with the various historical arguments that are cited for it because of the lack of prior intra-session recesses. I don't know that it's all that significant that it didn't happen before President Johnson. Another of the arguments is about the fact that they used the definite article. They talk about the recess. But I think that that is just what they did at the time to show that they were using a term generically or universally. In Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, they say the Senate shall choose their own officers and also a president pro tem in the absence of the vice president. And they didn't mean that there was going to be a singular absence of the vice president. They meant whenever the vice president is absent, they can appoint the president pro tem. This is, you know, in keeping with one of the general background ideas, which is that the Constitution was to be understood in the kind of ordinary language of the time, and if the House of Congress were out and unavailable, it would be considered to be in recess, whether it was an intra-session or intra-session. It has borne out somewhat by historical usage. In 1798, there was an appointment of a U.S. senator from New Jersey, which was made when the state legislature, which chose them at the time, was in an intra-session recess, and I think it fell to the executive at that time. And, you know, nobody thought that that was not during the recess just because it was an intra-session recess. And if you look at kind of correspondence, the Continental Congress was forever recommending to the legislatures or the executive powers in the recess of the legislature to do various things like procure blankets or clothing for the troops in the war. And I can't imagine they would say that that the executive was not empowered to act on that when the legislature was in an intercession recess as opposed to an intercession. And I can talk a little bit more about that during the question and answer if you're interested. Secondly, I think in some ways a stronger originalist argument is the question about the vacancies arising during the recess or happen to exist during the recess. Because when you say that may happen during the recess of the Senate, I think that the more appealing construction is that it arises during the recess. I think the contrary argument is less laughable than you might originally think. If you ask when a vacancy happened in the office of the vice president, one answer would be to say, you know, it happened on April 15, 1865, when Vice President Johnson became president and there was no vice president. I think you could also say the vacancy happened from 1865 until 1869 when Vice President Colfax arrived with President Grant. And, you know, I will concede to you that that's not the most natural reading, but it is not risible, I don't think. And for whatever it's worth, the historical usage certainly, at least since 1823, which is kind of the tail end of the founding era, the Monroe administration, the executive branch has consistently taken the view that happen to exist is the proper reading. There is some historical usage before that. There's evidence that John Adams made one appointment with a guy who's where the vacancy had arisen during the the Senate was in session, and so it just happened to exist, which would make it older than Marbury versus Madison. Jefferson, Edward Hartnett, the academic claims at least made them. And I think Madison himself, whose silhouette is on our neckties, plainly made them no later than April 13th, 1813. So there's some founding era precedent supporting the idea that it's happened to exist. But for whatever it's worth, one thing that I think is interesting to think about is the implications of all of this. And on the one hand, I think if there happened to be intercession recesses, which I don't know if that is a foregone conclusion that there will be any. The D.C. Circuit's ruling does some things to kind of lower the significance of recess appointments and reduce the confrontation with the legislative branch. Because, for starters, intra-session recess appointments last longer because you not only get the whole session where you're appointed, but then you get the next one as well. But because of that, intra-session recess appointments last longer. And I think that, by and large, they probably last about as long as confirmed officers would hold their offices anyway before they head on to greener pastures. I think, likewise, if you only used recess appointment power for vacancies that arose during the recess, it would be less obviously a way for the president to put people into office who the Senate hasn't acted on anyway. I think that the Senate might not like people who, when you act to fill a vacancy that only arose while the Senate was out, the person who is put into the office is more likely to be a relative stranger to Congress, and so it may be bad from that perspective. But it also means that it would be less, it would seem less like you're thumbing your nose at the Senate. Now, speaking of the implications, just briefly of the implications of the D.C. Circuit's ruling, for starters, this intra-session versus inter-session, because intra-session recess appointments last longer, they're more common, and both President Bush and President Obama have made more intra-session appointments than inter-session appointments, they're the first presidents in history to do that. But that in itself would invalidate 141 of President Bush's 171 recess appointments and the vast majority of President Obama's. If it stands, I think that it is definitely going to cut back a lot on the president's recess appointment authority. I think that this arise versus exist idea is the easiest to get around. That is, it's the most likely not to be consequential because so many of the people who the president recess appoints are people in his administration, and you have to assume that the current occupant will play ball and resign when the Senate is out. But the intra-session versus inter-session, I think, is potentially more disruptive because unless the Senate is in friendly hands, the Senate leadership would be able to defeat it by having very long intra-session recesses and very, very short inter-session breaks. In one sense, the pro forma recesses are the narrowest holding. That is, if the Supreme Court were to affirm this and do it on the basis that pro forma sessions are valid to defeat the recess appointment of power, in one sense that would be the narrowest because it would invalidate the fewest recess appointments. But in another sense, it is the most far-reaching because if upheld, we very likely have seen the last of recess appointments unless all three branches are in the hands of the same party, because it is no longer enough that the Senate be in the same hands as the president, because of the adjournment clause, the House can force the Senate to go into pro forma session by just saying, look, we're not going to consent for you to go out for Christmas recess or August recess or any of the recesses, and so it would force the Senate to go into pro forma session. And I think that is all I'm going to impose on you, although I've looked a little bit at the implications of the D.C. Circuit's opinion for the actions of past recess appointees, that is not the NLRB members, but say Judge Pryor during the Bush administration. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. This is Dean Reuter once again. I do want to give Rachel Brand and Howard Radsley a minute or two longer, but before I do that, why don't we open the floor to questions and people can ring in expressing their interest to answer or ask a question. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, you'll push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for one of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button. Our lines are open, and while folks are ringing in, let me give Rachel just a minute or two to add to her opening remarks, and then we'll go to Howard Radsley.
Sure. Thanks, Dean, and thanks to John and Howard. That was really interesting. I thought John did a good job of explaining the arguments on both sides, frankly, in terms of the history of the recess appointments clause. One thing that neither John nor I really got into very much is this notion of whether the president can unilaterally define when the Senate is in recess for purposes of the recess appointments clause. There's a long line of AG opinions claiming that the president is the one who can determine whether the Senate's in recess under that clause. The Senate, of course, or members of the Senate anyway, in this case, disagreed with that notion and argued that the Senate really should be the arbiter of when it is in recess, and partially because of the Rules and Proceedings Clause in the Constitution that allows each House of Congress to set its own rules. The Republican senators who filed the amicus brief in our case made that point. And then the D.C. Circuit, frankly, dismissed kind of with a backhanded slap this notion that the president can make that determination unilaterally. I think the court said that will not do or this will not do or something like that. So that's one interesting aspect of the case. Just to elaborate a little bit on what Howard talked about in terms of cases in the D.C. Circuit being held, the court has kind of on a rolling basis been holding briefing in abeyance in cases that would implicate the recess appointments issue. So they're very brief orders the court is making on its own motion that simply say that briefing is held in abeyance until further order of the court. Doesn't say whether that means until the government decides whether to appeal or what it means, but presumably they're waiting for the government to seek further resolution of the case. Numerous 28J letters have been filed in those cases apprising the court of the issue and so forth. Just recently, the court started to hold cases implicating Mr. Becker's recess appointment, the prior recess appointment to the board. And there are, of course, cases pending all around the country in other circuits in which the recess appointments issue is raised. There are cases in the Fourth Circuit, Fifth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, other circuits perhaps. And actually, the Chamber's website, if you go to www.chamberlitigation.com, we have a page that lists all of those cases. If you're litigating one of those cases and want to see the pleadings in other cases, you can go there and take a look. But I'd be interested to hear from either Howard or John whether you think the government will appeal Noel Canning. And I should point out that there is a circuit split already on both aspects of the court's ruling. The 11th Circuit, when Judge Pryor was appointed to the 11th Circuit, there was a challenge to that appointment, and the 11th Circuit ruled that intra-session appointments are permissible. It declined to say how long the recess needed to be, but it said that the 11-day recess at issue there was long enough. So that provides a split on the intra versus intersession recess question. And in terms of the may happen question, there are a couple of older cases from the, I think, ones from the 60s, ones from the 80s, from the Second and Ninth Circuits that dealt with the may happen question. And in both of those cases, the court held that may happen means may happen to exist during, not may happen to arise during, and both of those cases involved judicial recess appointments. So in light of the existence of a split, I'd be curious to know whether John and Howard think the government will appeal or if they'll wait for the split to deepen.
Rachel, this is Howard. A couple thoughts. First, in terms of what I think the government would do, I mean, it's interesting because I think if they're counting noses at the D.C. Circuit, it's unlikely that if they sought en banc review, they would get a more favorable determination. And I agree with you that I think the split is enough, particularly given the importance of this question, that it's hard for me to believe the Supreme Court doesn't take the case. In fact, I was a little surprised they didn't seek expedited review to try to get it heard this term, which they may have been able to do if they moved very quickly after the D.C. Circuit ruled. But I think this is going to be heard by the Supreme Court, and it will probably be heard next next term, given the time the government's already taken. And at this point, I think I'd be a little bit surprised if they sought en banc review. But, you know, I guess there may be some at DOJ who think that may be a viable alternative. In terms of the merits, I disagree with one thing particular that John said, that this notion of the recess appointments in the adjournment clause and the 3 days between the pro forma sessions would potentially be in some ways a broader ruling, because I think as it stands, if the D.C. Circuit's ruling were upheld, and I'll comment on that in 1 minute, but in its analysis, not just its holding, this would be basically the end of recess appointments, because you would basically need a supermajority to ever have a recess appointment, because either the House or the Senate could prevent any kind of recess. And so you'd end up with basically at noon on the appointed day, the old session would end, and almost instantaneously the new session would begin, making it virtually impossible for people to resign and the president to recess appoint people to positions. So I don't really see it as any more of a threat. And actually, when I read the decision, I thought the president had gone too far basically to eviscerate any ability of the Senate to prevent recess appointments by basically saying that a recess is like pornography. I know it when I see it, except the eye is the president. And I think this decision, I'd be surprised. Well, I think this decision, the holding of the result will be upheld. I would be surprised if there were 5 votes for the very textualist interpretation taken by the D.C. Circuit. I think it's much more likely that the Supreme Court would affirm, but on a much more narrow ground, probably or potentially equating the adjournment and the recess clause, which had been the position that the executive branch had taken for years. In fact, in a case in the D.C. Circuit in 2004, Evans versus Stevens, they took it in the 11th Circuit, and the Supreme Court. In New Process Steel, they equated the 3 days in the adjournment clause to the recess appointment power. So I think it's fairly likely that the case may go that way, as opposed to on the much broader rationale that the D.C. Circuit went on, although I think they will clearly get that analysis will clearly garner some votes from the textualists on the court.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. Again, we have just one question at this point. If you have a question for either of our any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and let's go to our first caller.
This is John Irving. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, John. Go ahead.
Okay. This is a very interesting session, and I really compliment the presenters doing such a great job in a short period of time. What I think I have is reliable information that the Justice Department does not intend to seek en banc consideration and will appeal, but in a manner that has it taken up next term and not this term. No expedition, no emergency. And I think those determinations have been made by and large without consultation with the NLRB. And it's kind of interesting, because if they were to seek en banc consideration, it's possible that the author of the opinion, Judge Sentelle, would not be in the en banc group, because he's taking senior status. But in any event, the Justice Department, I've been told, believes that it's not ready to take this case up and have it considered by the Supreme Court, because, you know, I guess they feel they haven't really done sufficient research and so on. So anyway, they are the best information I have is that it will be fall and not before. Just one other point. I don't know how the president has just reappointed or proposed the two board members, Griffin and Block, and I don't know exactly what the impact of that is. Their names have been sent up, and I don't know whether the Vacancies Act comes into play in a way that would add give the board some basis for arguing that it has the proper consistency or composition going forward.
John, this is Howard. I am not surprised that DOJ would make the decision without regard to or even discussion with the NLRB, given the, consequences to all the recess appointments, to other recess appointments of, that President Obama has made, and the implications for the executive branch writ large. Nor am I surprised, given that I think this decision probably took them by surprise, not that they would have lost, but that the D.C. Circuit would have gone down this rationale, that they're taking their time to get their proverbial ducks in a row. Overall, I too thought it was very interesting that the president sent up the two recess appointments, because I know to a certainty that at least one, and I believe two, Republican nominees to the board are in fact ready to go. And given some of the statements made by members of both parties in recent weeks, I was a little surprised that the Obama administration would put up just the two Democrats and not the two Republicans, although given the activist board and some of the decisions over the last 12 months upsetting with only two votes, decades of board law, it would not surprise me if the board remained deadlocked without confirmed members for years to come, because I think there are a lot on the Hill that would rather see the board out of business than in business, given the direction it's going, particularly if they can prevent the board from operating by prohibiting recess appointments. Although you do raise an interesting question about whether the president could use his authority to appoint somebody to a position under the Vacancies Act. There are some implications from being renominated and having served in the position that potentially would allow you to act under the Vacancies Act, although I would note if the recess appointments are void ab initio, I doubt that that would allow them to be the to act under the Vacancies Act, which would require you to actually have been at the agency for some period of time before the vacancy arose. And there's a bunch of other complications which are probably beyond this call, but it's a very good point about the Vacancies Act.
Yeah, just one other point on the agency being able to function. Keep in mind that there the separation between the general counsel and the board, and there are many things that where the general counsel does not need, in connection with unfair labor practice cases, does not need board concurrence with procedures, and regional directors can act in unfair labor practice area, conducting investigations, issuing complaints, and so on, without approval in case by case of the board. And so the general counsel and the general counsel too, in case of secondary boycotts, if general counsel finds that a complaint can issue, general counsel can go. Unlike 10J, under 10L, the general counsel is authorized, indeed required, in the event that he's going to issue a complaint, to go for an injunction in district court. So that half of the agency having to do with unfair labor practice cases and issuance of complaints, as long as they have a validly appointed general counsel, and his term is going to be expiring at some point fairly soon. But in any event, right now, this decision doesn't really affect, I don't believe, the administration of the unfair labor practice section of the act. The general counsel can go forward.
There is a question, though, about the validity of the appointment of some of the regional directors, because those appointments require approval of the board.
Yeah, that's true, but both the regs and the interpretation over the years has been that if the board doesn't appoint a general counsel, the general counsel can authorize regional directors to act on his 3D behalf, and the general counsel doesn't need any authorization from the board in order to be able to do that. So even regional directors would be able to go forward with their respective unfair labor practice responsibilities.
Yeah, John, I think you raise a good point, although with the exception of secondary boycotts, most of what the general counsel can do can eventually be stymied if either the union or the employer were to appeal to the board itself. And, of course, then the board can't act on that if there's no board. So as a practical matter, most of what the
case could, if the general counsel issues a complaint, general counsel could go forward with a trial before an administrative law judge. That case, no matter how it's decided, wouldn't be getting to the board for another year or two.
Oh, no, no, right, absolutely. And it's not like the board would be, I mean, even if this stayed for years to come, the general counsel presumably would have the obligation to continue to bring those cases, prosecute the complaints, and get them to the point where either they settled or they were queued up for appeal to the board. And, of course, some of the potential things the board were trying to do in terms of, like, quickie election and things like that, if they would have been upheld, could have actually implicated that as well.
And there could also be, in unfair labor practices, some cases, there could be some problems with subpoena enforcement, too, even for the general counsel.
Dean, this is Rachel. I don't know if there are other questions in the queue, but if there are not, I'd be interested to have John follow up on what he mentioned at the end of his remarks about the what impact the decision has on the actions of past recent appointments, such as Judge Pryor, and there were other judicial recent appointments also in the last couple of administrations.
Yeah, let me before we go there, let me just make two quick announcements. One, I'm reliably informed, John Irving, that a senior judge who is on an original panel participates in the en banc panel if there is one. So Centel would stay in the en banc panel if the administration is doing that kind of math. And before we get to Rachel's follow-up with John Elwood, let me say that tomorrow we're hosting a teleforum conference call on national security and intelligence leaks. That's going to be tomorrow at 12 noon Eastern time at the same number. On Friday, our topic for our teleforum call is going to be federal criminal prosecutions, looking at some of the limitations there with our guest experts, Conrad Black, Bill Otis, and Ellen Podgore. That's going to be Friday at 2 p.m. And, of course, for a schedule of other calls taking place next week and beyond, check in regularly with our website because that schedule changes quite often. If you have a question today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open at this point, but let me turn it back over to John Elwood. John, if you want to respond to Rachel's query.
Sure. I think that the strongest claim in some ways involves judges, although the problem, I think, for most people is that fairly few judges have been recess appointed in the last few decades. In fact, I think Pryor and Gregory are it, aren't they? And so, pardon me?
There have been a couple others.
I think that before that, it might go back to the Carter administration, but I'm not sure.
Southwick, I believe.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Pickering was an intercession. Right.
Yeah, and then if you include, like, the Court of Federal Claims, there was one of the administration,
right.
But that's not Article 3, so, yeah.
Mm. But the thing is, though, de facto officer doctrine, which confers validity upon the acts performed by a person acting under color of official title, even if it's later discovered that the legality of the appointment suffers in some way. But de facto officer doctrine is pretty hard on people who are making such challenges kind of down the road. If you have if you immediately challenge the action and prosecute it, the law is pretty good for challenging such things. But down the road, de facto officer doctrine is going to shut it off. And it's fairly, you know, recent precedent from 1999 in the Supreme Court Ryder versus United States. Saying basically you're out of luck if you're more or less trying to collaterally attack something. So given that the most recent Article 3 appointment is Judge Gregory, I think they're kind of out of luck there. De facto officer doctrine has been applied some in the administrative context. Like everything else, if you read Buckley versus Vallejo long enough, there's precedent in it that says virtually everything. And on the 142nd page of Buckley versus Vallejo, they accord to FEC decisions validity under the de facto officer doctrine, even though apparently there was some problem with the appointments there. Also, Howard has adverted to the fact that there is ratification. There's fairly good law saying that if a later officer has authority to take the action at the time of ratification, they can ratify the actions of an earlier official, and the D.C. Circuit has generally given their blessing to that in an opinion from the late 90s. But again, that depends on there being a later official who can ratify it. And that is about all I know on the subject.
We do have about 4 minutes left, 5 minutes left. We've got another audience member question. Why don't we go to the next question?
Hi, this is Mike Stern. I came in a little bit late, so excuse me if this has already been answered, but I was wondering if the panelists have any thoughts about the possibility that the administration would make new recess appointments, either just as a way of defying the D.C. Circuit or as a way of challenging the issue in some other circuit. And I believe that there's a recess coming up, which is not where they're, as far as I've heard, they're not still doing the pro forma sessions, although I could be wrong about that. So I'm wondering if anyone has any thoughts.
Who wants to respond to that?
This is John Elwood. I think that even though some of what they've done is the administration has done is pretty aggressive, as I believe it was Rachel indicated, they've more or less just said they're going to go ahead and NLRB as business as usual. And as I think Howard said, they're actually people who a court has said are improperly appointed are themselves making appointments. But I think that a recess appointment at this point would just be, I think, too visibly thumbing their nose at the judiciary unless it were somehow, exempt. That is, if it were an intercession recess and it were made for a vacancy that happened to arise during the recess of the Senate. So I suspect that we've seen the last of the presidential recess appointments until we have a final answer on the validity of these appointments.
Howard Radley or Rachel Brand, you want to get in on this point?
I think that's right. I think it would be asking for trouble to make a recess appointment now before there's resolution of the issue. I don't see them doing that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think more likely the president may try to use his authority under the Vacancies Act in areas like, for example, the board, where he may be able to do that. And in fact, I believe Leif Solomon's been operating under he's not a recess appointment. He's been operating under the Vacancies Act. And so you can do that. There's a limit to the amount of time you can do it, but it's a considerable period of time where you can do that.
But Howard, as you alluded to earlier, too, the Vacancies Reform Act has limitations such as you have to have served in the agency for a certain period of time in the preceding year at a certain level of pay and so forth. And so if the president tried to appoint a board member who had not been validly serving in the agency at all, I don't see that passing muster under the Vacancies Reform Act. Not that there couldn't be somebody else potentially for other positions who could be appointed under that act as an acting officer, but I don't see the president being able to take the questionably appointed recess appointees and making them acting if the invalidity of their appointments is upheld anyway.
I think, Rachel, that's correct. But for example, potentially he could use the act to appoint Leif Solomon, for example, if the other criteria of the Vacancies Act met, if it were a career or other person who'd been there when the vacancy arose. I think that's right, but even that gets into be an interesting question given the myriad of recess appointments to the various positions.
Well, it appears we're just about out of time. Let me thank our experts on behalf of the Federalist Society. I want to thank Rachel Brand, John Elwood, and Howard Radley for joining us today. It's a fascinating call, a fascinating topic, a lot left to be decided, it seems. To our audience, I invite you to join us for our Teleform conference call tomorrow at noon Eastern at this same number when we'll be discussing national security and intelligence leaks. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.